Hello, in this audio clip, we will finish, hopefully, talking about the 10th pillar of the new American Constitution, which is the 5th fundamental human right, which is the right to a personal domain. And there isn't really much more that we can say, especially because this right is probably the most complex of all the rights. The most complex in terms of how to define it in a clear way, because it entails giving or recognizing a person's right to establish a kingdom and have a certain level of sovereignty around the things that happen and the people that are allowed into that kingdom. And that, in many ways, clashes or can clash with the other rights that individuals have. And in finding that line where a person is exercising his right to a personal domain versus him violating someone else's rights, that line is a very fine line and very difficult to define at times. So there really isn't much more that we can say at this time about this right. We'll just share a few more parameters that can be taken into account. And I believe that as time goes on, these ideas will become much more precise as the time comes when the new American Constitution is finally implemented. We said previously that one of the parameters that can be used to define whether the right to a personal domain is being exercised correctly is that within that right, you as the king of that domain have the power to exercise a certain level of judgment over the behavior of others. And it's a judgment of behavior, not a judgment of inherent value. So even though you have a personal kingdom, a personal domain, which in many cases takes the form of a business, also, as we said before, it can be your private home, your place of residence. It can also be something like you establishing some sort of social club where you define the rules of how things are to be, you know, like all these societies that get established where they have all these rituals and all these rules and all these levels and how you go from one level to another by following certain rituals. All of that is part of a person's right to a personal domain. If you want to create that virtual world, where you have, all these rights and all these levels and people are willing to participate in those, in that world that you're creating, that's your thing and you have the right to do it. So the concept of a personal domain can take many forms, but most of the time you could say, and for legal purposes, the personal domain has its greatest manifestation or most prevalent manifestation in the establishing of a business. So in a business, for example, we're giving the example of a baker who as it happened in real life, let's say would not bake a cake, a wedding cake for a homosexual wedding. And we said that previously that is an example of where the baker, being a Christian or being of some faith that is against homosexuality, has the right to exercise a certain level of judgment, saying, hey, I'm not, the judgment is not over the equality of the person. So it's not saying this person is inherently inferior, but it's a judgment on the behavior of the person. Now, whether the judgment is right or not is not exactly the point. As long as it's not an egregious judgment. But if there's a judgment there and it falls into this gray zone where there's ambiguity and there's not clarity on whether the judgment is correct or not correct, then there is a latitude that must be allowed for people to exercise that judgment. But it's a judgment on behavior. And some people might say that in the example of the homosexual wedding cake, it's not behavior because you're supposedly judging the person for what they are. For example, judging someone just because he or she is black or of another race or oriental or whatever. But in this case, in the case of homosexuality, it is behavior at the end of the day. It is not like race, and that's the problem that we've had in America and Europe and throughout the white world, you could say the European world, where this this analogy has been established between race and sexual behavior, and that is not correct. It is incorrect, and you could say, well, how can you say that? Some people are, you know, have homosexual tendencies from an early age or sometimes, and then they develop it, and you could say, oh, that's just them being who they are. Well, that is not necessarily a valid statement. And just consider, for example, let's say that you have a person who, a little baby, who is inside the womb of the mother, and let's say the mother is a drug addict, and the baby, becomes a drug addict along with the mother, and is born a drug addict. So he was born as a drug addict. Does that mean that we have to consider him as a drug addict? That was something he was born with, and therefore we should accept him as a drug addict as he grows up and, you know, gets into a lifestyle of drug and crimes. Can we just say, oh, that's who he is because he was born that way? Just because you're born a certain way does not mean that that is your essence or that that is an okay thing and that therefore it is acceptable necessarily. And somebody might say, well, that's not a good example because it involves something that that is really not part of your DNA. It was some chemical thing that was introduced into you from the outside. It's not something that came from within. Well, if you take that, let's say, then consider people who are born with certain congenital diseases, something that they are... that they inherit from their parents, and maybe some sort of dementia tendency, or hypertension, or something that comes from their genetic lineage, and some diseases that they inherit and that can cripple their lives. Can we say then, okay, because he or she was born with that, then it's an acceptable state? No, we look at it as a disease, and we then say, okay, how can we deal with this? Even though the person was born with it, we want to get rid of that trait, or that physical trait, that because we recognize it as something bad. So being born with something does not necessarily make it acceptable. It's like if someone is born with an extra arm sticking out of their stomach for some strange reason, can we say, oh, that we just have to accept them the way they are? They have that extra arm there, and that arm is, limiting their life, causing a lot of problems. If the person could have a surgery to remove that arm, then that unnecessary extra arm, then that would be what we would do. Or people who are born as Siamese twins. Something that we have to accept as the right thing, the right state of things, just because they were born that way? No. So just because you're born a certain with certain tendencies or born a certain way, like if you're born an alcoholic because your mother was an alcoholic, does that mean that we have to accept you caving to your alcoholic tendencies? And the answer is no. We all know that the answer is no. And in the case of homosexuality, there are a lot of factors that go beyond the scope of this audio clip that can affect a person's tendency towards going in that direction. And many of those things can even be traced back to ancestral roots, things like lines of thought that have run through that family. And thinking can shape DNA. DNA can shape thinking, and thinking can shape DNA. The discussion of that goes beyond the scope of this audio clip. But in short, people can allow certain patterns of thought and behavior to run through a family. For example, homosexuality is very strongly linked to a strongly abusive, legalistic authority figures in the ancestral line. So, if there's a constant suppression of a person's ability to exercise their authority because they are beaten down constantly, that slowly creates an avenue for homosexuality to get into that ancestral line. And and I would dare say that when those patterns of behavior are running through a family line, that you could maybe see certain distortions or mutations or something in the DNA and the genetics of that family that might lead to homosexuality manifesting itself in some people. But the fact that even if you can say it's congenital does not necessarily make it right or wrong. And as you might know, I don't think that anyone has ever been able to establish a specific gene saying, oh, okay, this is just not, it's not behavioral, it's not related to anything. It's just, just like people are born male or female, because some have the XY chromosome, some have the other combination, then that's what leads to somebody being born a man versus a woman. And then if you could argue that there's some sort of gene combination that produces homosexuality and it's kind of an inevitable thing, then you would could probably argue, okay, then it is just like race. But no one has ever been able to establish a gene that says, okay, yeah, it's not. And let me put it this way: when a baby is born, everybody knows, oh, it's a male or a female. We don't have to do a deep examination, a psychological examination, and DNA spectral analysis or anything. Everybody knows it's a boy or a girl. But can you do that to define sexual orientation with a boy? With let's say a boy is born, can somebody do an exam? Take some blood sample, go to do a lab test, and come back and say, oh, you just had a homosexual boy baby. No, it cannot be done. You have to let the kid grow, and then the kid grows. And then some, and somehow, in some cases, it slowly creeps in because of certain behaviors that the kid is exposed to. Sometimes it's a congenital thing in the sense that it's running through the family line, and somehow somebody opens the door, and it's always a thought. It always starts with a thought, a pattern of thinking that gets allowed into a person's heart, and it slowly develops, and then boom, some people develop homosexuality that way. So it's a pattern of behavior. And as it manifests itself, it's not a question of, okay, I just have the tendency and therefore I'll just live it out. It boils down to a decision that you make. And that's why race and sexual behavior cannot be, or sexual conduct or sexual tendencies cannot be equated, because a black man cannot have tendencies towards having black skin, if you know what I mean. An Oriental person cannot develop tendencies towards having eyes that look a certain way. It is so innate that you go, yes, that's how the person was born, and you recognize it as just a variety of humanity being manifested in different forms. But with sexual behavior, it's a choice. Because even if someone has homosexual tendencies, it does not necessarily mean that they have to carry out those tendencies. Just like a person who might have a family history of lechery, if they have fathers and grandfathers and so forth who have been very promiscuous, that also creates this ancestral line of promiscuous tendencies. So if a person wants to sleep around with all these people, just because he is born with this these tendencies does not mean that he is just required by law to carry them out. Everybody's the architect of their behavior. So they decide whether they will or will not do certain things. So that's why sexual behavior cannot be equated with race. You cannot decide to be or not be black, or not be or not be white. And that's why when we talk about this parameter of judgment of behavior in your personal domain, issues like this, homosexuality and all this can come into play. In the case, for example, of this baker who was asked to bake a cake to honor a wedding that is related to accepting a certain type of sexual behavior. And so it's behavior related. Now, if the person had been denied, let's say that they're at the supermarket they are paying at the cash register, and the cashier says, no, you cannot purchase here because you're a homosexual. That would be incorrect, because as we said, the second parameter is we can judge behavior, but it has to be pertaining to the service being rendered or requested. So what does the person's homosexual tendencies have to do with him or purchasing food at the supermarket? Because if you go by that standard, well, then there are a lot of people who are adulterers. So they are, maybe you know someone who is an adulterer, and everybody in the neighborhood knows he's an adulterer. He's sleeping around with three women in the neighborhood. Will the cashier at the local supermarket then deny him service? Well, if you can do it with homosexual behavior, because it's considered by, let's say, this cashier as deviant sexual behavior, well, can't you apply the same principle then to adultery? And this guy who's sleeping around with three different women, and everybody in the neighborhood knows it. So it just opens a can of worms. Then let's say someone is a Trump supporter, and the cashier doesn't like Trump, and the guy shows up with a MAGA hat. I'm not a fan of the MAGA hat for reasons that have to do with the last letter in that acronym. Make America great again, which assumes America was great. And as we've said before, America is probably the greatest nation on earth, has been, well, up until now, has been the greatest nation on earth, or at least one of the three greatest nations on earth, but it never really reached the greatness that it was supposed to have. And when we say make America great again, it's just saying let's go back to the past. And that's what conservatives want to do. So I'm not a fan of the MAGA hat to, by any stretch of the imagination. But if someone showed up with a MAGA hat, it would be ridiculous for the cashier to then say, "Hey, I'm not letting you buy at the supermarket because you're wearing that hat and I don't like it." So if you open that can of worms, it just degrades the entire system. So that's why the judgment of behavior in your personal domain has to be pertaining to the service being rendered or requested. You can't just randomly decide that you're not going to provide services to people just because they are engaging in wrong behavior if that wrong behavior has nothing to do with the service you are offering in your personal domain business. So the third thing we saw before was that you have to distinguish between private, and we were calling it personal, but I think the better word is private access versus public access. And that means that, for example, a supermarket is a place that's offering a very generic type of service. We started this personal domain, this business, and this business service involves providing you with groceries so that you can, you know, eat at home. And we are selling you these groceries. So there's a very public nature to it because you're opening your business to anybody to come in and buy groceries. So those types of personal domain businesses must remain generic in their parameters of acceptance. They cannot be too finicky. And obviously, when you open a supermarket and you put up the sign, you're saying, "I'm a generic place of purchase of groceries." So then the parameters of acceptance have to be very, very wide. But you could have a private club where you say, "Okay, this is a private club for people of a certain type." And that happens a lot, like, say, with nightclubs, but when they have bouncers and people outside who are deciding, these are the sexy people, we'll let them in, and the ugly, unsexy people, they will stay out. It's a very unfair parameter in many ways, I would say. But the person who owns the nightclub has, within his right to a personal domain, that right to say, "I want a nightclub for just the sexy people, and the good-looking people, and all the ugly people can stay home or go somewhere else." But it's a private place. It's not some sort of public hall where people are going to do square dancing or something. When you see the sign outside, it says exclusive nightclub, and everybody knows it has a certain exclusivity to it. So then the parameters can be more finicky, more arbitrary, but it has to be clear at the entrance that is a private place, not a public place like a supermarket or, let's say, a generic bookstore and so forth. So there has to be this distinguishing between private versus public access. Another parameter to consider when trying to understand this right to a personal domain, when it is being abused or not abused, is that the more pervasive a domain is, the more public it becomes. And that means that, let's say, for example, like Microsoft, they started a software company, and then they started offering an operating system, and this operating system, became a part of a great number of computers, and it's now being run by a significant percentage. So that the more pervasive the software became, then the more public it also becomes, in the sense that before, when they were this, small company, they could have certain niche qualities to their software, and they could be finicky and more arbitrary in certain things that they did. But the more pervasive they became, then the more power they acquired. And now, for example, they could, I could be wrong in saying this. I am not 100% right, sure if this is correct, but from what I understand, for example, Windows 11 that came out not too many months ago, from the time of this recording, the home edition, in other words, not the professional business edition, apparently, from what I've heard, I'm not 100% sure, requires that you have internet access in order for your computer to run Windows. Let's assume that's the case. If that's not the case, let's just take this as a hypothetical example. But assuming that's the case, that means that if I have Windows 11 and I don't have an internet connection, then I cannot connect. I cannot really access my own computer. And that, if that's the case, that would be a violation of my personal domain, because it's my computer. And if I don't want to be connected to the internet, I don't want to be monitored, I don't want to, data to be coming out of my computer out into the world. I just want to type a letter, and I don't need to be connected to the internet to type it. Why am I being demanded to connect to the internet? And if I'm not mistaken, that's not the case with Windows 11 Professional, the business edition, because I'm pretty sure that Microsoft knew that if that was the case, businesses would complain. And so they, but if you have an individual, your typical soccer mom, as they call it in the U.S., who doesn't have power, quote unquote, and she's being imposed this rule, you cannot use your computer unless you connect it to the internet, because we want to monitor what you're doing. And we want to control what you're doing, and want to be able to download all the updates that we want to update into your computer, whether you like it or not, whether you have limited data bandwidth, internet bandwidth. We don't give a damn. We are Microsoft, and we will tell you how to run your life. And because it's a soccer mom, it's not a business, doesn't have a legal team and all that, then they just have to accept it. So that's an example of how it can happen that a service that is supposed to have a certain generic quality to an operating system that could at the beginning have had this very kind of exclusive quality to it, where it demands all these things in order to be used, starts losing that private quality the more pervasive it becomes. So it's up to the company. So if they don't want you want if they want to serve a niche, a niche, and they want to serve that niche alone, then they can be a more finicky, more private, but they know that they will have a limited market. But if they want to succeed and become more powerful, more successful, then they will have to open up. And as they open up and become more pervasive and go into more markets, they know that that makes them more public. And then their parameters have to remain or become more and more generic. And that's where the concept of monopoly busting comes in. I'm a little... reluctant to believe that constitutionally we should institute the concept of monopoly breaking, Teddy Roosevelt style. But because that also gives the government sometimes an unnecessary power to break up a business just because it wants to, and it feels like that sometimes can be a violation of the right to a personal domain and also the right to property. But it is important that, yes, well, let's let the domain become more pervasive and expand. But the more pervasive it becomes, then it becomes more generic. It's like, for example, if you have a social media app that's used for people, used by people to communicate with each other, the more pervasive it becomes, the more generic its levels of acceptance must be. But the sad thing is, what we've seen, in the current environment is that the more pervasive social media domain becomes, then it becomes more of an excuse for them to become much more limiting and establish more and more arbitrary censorship. So it's gone the other way. So it's because they feel, now that we have all these people and that all these people depend on us to communicate with each other, now we can impose our religion on them, because white liberalism is a religion. They act like religious fanatics. They have this blind faith in this ideology, and they act like it. They're self-righteous about it, arrogant, and they are very violent against anyone who disagrees with them. Like what happened with the recently with these hackers, who at the time of this recording hacked into a website that was receiving donations to support what's happening in Canada with some truckers who are fighting against the oppression of Justine Trudeau. And the correct pronunciation is Trudeau. That's how you have to pronounce the name of that little bastard, fascist son of a bitch. So these people, these truckers are fighting against this little Trudeau, and people were donating to support them in their cause, and then this website that was receiving donations got hacked, violently hacked by these crazy people, they hacked the website and put up some very harsh, offensive messages against the people donating. And that's what religious nut jobs do. That's religious fanatics behave like that. Crazy religious fanatics who are willing to destroy. Just like the bastards who brought down the Twin Towers here in New York. Religious fanatics. It's like, no, we are going to destroy anyone who disagrees with us, who opposes us in any way, shape, or form. So. So these people are fanatics, and as they have succeeded in enlarging their personal domains, they have used it as an opportunity to then start encroaching on people's rights, without realizing that the principle is in reverse. The more pervasive your domain becomes, the more public it then becomes, and the more public it becomes, the more generic its parameters of acceptance must be. So that's a fourth principle or parameter by which we have to, or we can define the limits of that right to a personal domain. Then a fifth parameter, which is more or less related to the others, is that we have to define the difference between essential versus customized. In other words, there are certain services that are provided that are essential. For example, food, transport, education, and certain basic things. Those things have to remain generic in their parameters of acceptance. For example, we can't have a situation where somebody establishes a person domain that provides food, and we start having these businesses, these food businesses, restricting themselves to just white people, the way it happened in the South for a long time, where, you know, white-only restaurants, only whites can attend this university, and so forth. There are certain things that are essential, and if you allow personal domains to restrict and kind of work together to restrict essential services to people of a certain race or a certain social class, financial standing. I don't believe in classes. That's communist talk. We've gotten so used to saying it. I sometimes inadvertently say it, middle class, upper class. That's all Marxist lingo. We're not classes. We're not there's no royalty and regular people. It should be just one group of people and different, you know, with different financial standings probably, but they're not classes. Classes assume that there is this permanent separation between one group of people and another, which does not exist in America and does not exist in a fair society. I apologize for using the word class, but the thing is that essential services if they start getting limited to a certain racial group or a certain social group of people, financial group, then something bad is happening. The personal right to a personal domain is being misused, and therefore has to be curtailed through legislation in some way, shape, or form. But just like there are essential services, there are customized services. Like, for example, in the case of the baker with the cake for the homosexual wedding, it's not like a human, it's not like life as they know it will end. Like, they have no freedom. If no one wants to bake a cake for their homosexual thing, they can in any case just go to a bakery and say, hey, just give me a cake of this size, and they will make the cake, and then they can go buy some sort of frosting or whatever, one of those tubes, and just write their own message on the wedding cake, and then they'll have the cake they want. It's a non-essential service, and the fact that there's no bakery, let's say that all the bakers are Christians in that town, and not a single bakery in that town is going to bake that cake. It's a non-essential service. They are not being deprived of their right to life, or their right to property, or any of the other rights. It's a limitation because that society, that town, is judging them on that behavior, on that specific behavior. But it's not saying you can't eat. It's not depriving them of food for eating. It's not depriving them of an opportunity to have a decent work, a job, a decent a salary, or whatever. It's depriving them of a specific cake, which they can kind of put together on their own. It's not that big of a deal. But in this case, in this case, they were trying to make a point. That's what they wanted. They just wanted to find a way to attack those who don't agree with them. So we have to distinguish between what's essential and what is more or less non-essential or customized, like something very particular. So that's a parameter to use. And the other last thing that we're going to say about that's right, is that that authority has to become involved. And by authority, we mean, you know, the legislative branch, and obviously also the executive and judicial branches, but mostly the legislative branch has to be focused on or become involved in monitoring the personal domain's subtle encroachment on individual rights, and go by this guideline that the limitations that these personal domains may impose on others have to be reasonable. And the problem is it's sometimes very difficult to define what is reasonable versus what is not reasonable. Like, for example, let's say that somebody wants to start a club or a group for just men. And that's what they want. They just want a group for men because men tend to have certain tastes. Maybe it's not that 100% of the men will always want or be interested in the same things, but there's a tendency. Just like women are more interested in certain things, men are more interested in certain other things. So if someone wants to start a club just for men, there is a certain common sense taste to that. Or a club just for women, because it's women who have certain tastes and are interested in certain things, and they want to start this maybe a business or whatever, a business service that caters to women. It's just for women. So if it falls within a certain level of reasonable, a reasonable quality to it, then it should be acceptable. So it's very difficult to define. Like, for example, we have sports. We have usually been divided into men's sports and women's sports. And men are not allowed, well, not up until now, used to not be allowed to participate in women's sports and vice versa. And there was a reason for it. And there was a common sense explanation for it. Men are generally bigger, stronger, faster. That's just the genetics of it. And people can argue all they want. That's just the fact of life. It just doesn't mean women are inferior. It's just that men are bigger, stronger, and faster. And women are smaller and not as fast and not as strong. So it's unfair to, if women want to be given the opportunity to compete and have fun and enjoy a sport, they have to be allowed to play, you know, on their own and not allow men into their events. So those separations make sense. And if someone wants to start a football club and say only men are allowed, or because, you know, women could get injured if they play, or someone wants to start a football club just for women, then that falls within common sense and therefore should be allowed. But there are certain other things where, for example, if someone says only a man can become a CEO of the company, then it starts, the question becomes why, what is it about a man that makes this job only for a man? Maybe if the service being provided is very specific to men, for some reason, I can't think of one right now, but if that's the case, then there might be a reasonable explanation for that. But generally there will not be, because what does the gender of the person have to do with their intelligence or their ability to think things through? So limitations have to fall within reasonable parameters. And authority must be on the lookout. So, like when things were happening in the South with all the segregation, all these personal domains that were conspiring, all of them together to oppress a certain group of people, authority should have been on the lookout and said, "Hey, there's something going on here. We have to break this, and do what needs to be done." And sometimes we have to apply very specific rules. to cut into that and then break it. And once it's broken, maybe we can then start pulling those laws out from the law books again. So but it's all very has to be very targeted, very focused, and very specific, and it's very difficult to define very generic parameters, at least from what I can understand. That's what we have to say in very vague terms about the right to a personal domain. So we have finished the 10 pillars of the new American Constitution. And just to summarize the 10 pillars, the first pillar can be phrased in many ways, but it basically boils down to recognizing the existence of authority, that there is an authority out there that is independent of us and that we are to submit to it. And that kind of is the first foundation of the rule of law, this awareness that there is a truth out there that we are to submit to. We are not like animals in the law, you know, living by the law of the jungle. And we are a society, and we are have to each individual recognize, yes, there is an authority out there, and I'm to submit to it. I just have to understand what that authority is. But it's independent of me, and I am to submit to it. And the second pillar more or less said that that authority that is out there is not cannot be limited to temporal visible things, and that pillar is important to kind of break dictatorships, because dictatorships are based on that pillar being violated. Because people say, yes, I believe in authority. And, oh yeah, my authority is Mussolini. He is everything to me. And everything Mussolini says must be true because Mussolini said it, and I'm not going to question it. So they start giving this eternal value to this temporal little guy. I don't know how tall he was, but historically speaking, this little guy. That is a violation of pillar number two. And they do it also with parties. Like in certain countries, certain parties become the god of the country, like the PRI in Mexico. So whatever the party said, that must be the truth, but it's just a temporal institution. Very flawed at that and very corrupt, or like the Communist Party in China, things like that. That dictatorships are founded on the violation of pillar number two. So it's, yes, we recognize authority, but we're not going to pin it down on a specific temporal organization or person or institution. It transcends all of that. It's eternal, and it is metaphysically out there, and you can't just pin it down or reduce it to something small and temporal, like an organization or a party or a person or an institution. So pillar number three was that, yes, I recognize authority. I don't restrict it to individuals, and I am not going to use it for my own personal gain. So it's not using authority as a means to achieve personal or self-centered ends. And that is fundamental in having a government without corruption. So you can't use your position of authority to lord it over other people, abuse other people, and you know, the way the Democrats here in America do all the time. You don't get into a position of power or authority just to have privilege and take advantage of people. That's what they do in corrupt governments. So pillar number three is that very basic principle that you don't do anything. You don't use authority just to satisfy your own personal self-centered ends. And just as a side note, a very important outgrowth of this pillar will be in the New American Constitution, the limitation of salaries in all government workers. No one should be allowed, and I believe a parameter would be something like, no one should be allowed to make more than 1.5 times the average household income. So for example, if the average household in America makes $60,000 a year, then no government employee, no matter if it's the president or the greatest congressman in the history of mankind, or the White House janitor, no one in government should be able to make more than $90,000 a year, assuming $60,000 is the average of an American household. So it will behoove the government to have the American people prosper. If Americans start making $100,000 a year on average, then they can have their salary increased to a maximum of $150,000. No one can make that amount of money. So you can't get into government just to become rich, you know, like whores, like Pelosi and that son of a bitch from Utah that I always forget his name, Harry Reid. You know, people who become millionaires. Or Joe Bite Me, the senile bastard in the White House at the time of this recording, whose son has made millions through the use of his daddy's corrupt influence. All of that is a violation of Commandment Number 3, and the Constitution will, the new American Constitution will focus on making sure that pillar number 3 is respected and honored. And one of those keys will be to limit salaries so that if you go into public service, you're going as a servant and you're not going to make too much money, not even the president of the United States, because you're not there to achieve personal self-centered ends. You're there to be a servant. And the fourth pillar would be that to truly understand authority requires occasional and deliberate detachment from the temporal thing. It's like recognizing that to achieve perfection, you have to, you know, do certain things, apply certain laws, and then after applying them, then take a sabbatical in a sense, in a figurative sense, and look back and say, okay, how did these laws work? That they produce the desired end result. If not, then what do we do to change them? What concept did we miss as we were trying to apply these this legislation? So this constant re-examining and recognizing, no, we can't just assume that we're just going to plaster some ideas and that's just perfection and we don't ever have to think about it again ever. No, there's this constant examination, and that, for example, like the stupid laws that have been, or mandates that have been passed at the time of this recording, related to the virus that emanated from Wuhan, China. They passed these laws, all these mandates, and then never look back and say, okay, did it really stop the disease? Well, how did it make things worse? Did more people die because of our stupid mandates? How much did this really stop the spread of the disease? They don't do that, and the data clearly shows all of that hasn't worked. You compare what countries, the numbers in countries that didn't have the mandates versus countries that did, and you see, my goodness. In many cases, there's no difference at all. In some cases, the countries with no mandates did better. But no one is examining that. We're just driving on it with the madness. And the same with conservatives, believing that what the founding fathers left behind has been working, and suddenly the liberals came along and destroyed it all, when in reality it had been degrading for a long period of time. It was just these holes that were just waiting. It's like somebody leaving the door open to their house. And finally the robbers started just coming in droves, And then they get they're offended and surprised, but they had left the door open all that time because conservatives never bothered to go back and judge the founding fathers and say, hey, we admire some of the things you did, but you did these things and you were idiots in implementing these things. So let's fix it. We can't, just blame them for all our woes. We have to get up and be the architects of our destiny and fix it. But to fix things, we have to declare we cannot fix something that we don't believe is broken or incomplete. But because we have violated that pillar, number four, we are in the mess we're in. Conservatives are idiots because they don't understand the need to judge what was left behind, all the flaws in the Constitution. And we're living the consequences. We're living through this mess, and we're still collectively not looking back and analyzing anything. Conservatives don't do it. Liberals don't do it. And that's why we're in the mess we're in. And it's depressing because it just doesn't seem to go anywhere. And it gets so frustrating. The pillar number five entails basically the idea that even though you don't assign eternal value to temporal entities, like a dictator or a party or whatever, you still recognize that authority will have manifestations in the temporal. So it's not like being ethereal and say, oh, I believe in authority, it's out there, but it will never materialize in any physical form, so don't you come tell me what to do with my life. No, if a police officer says, hey, you broke the law and I'm going to arrest you, and let's say it's a legitimate law, not the stupid laws like those little bastard boys, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, those little bastard boys, white fascist liberal bastards were running around beating people up under the orders of Trudeau. So let's say it's a legitimate police officer coming to apply the law on you. Even if it's a little old lady, with a little baton, made out of plastic, because even if she's weak, she represents authority. And if she's coming under the coming to apply a legitimate law, you are to recognize it and abide by it. That's recognizing pillar number five, that authority can have its manifestation in weak vessels, and that those weak vessels, their authority is not judged by how much power they have, but by how much truth is behind them. That's what determines the authority they have. So it's not that, and pillar number five is violated in many places, like in Latin America, where you are the authority if you have the bigger baton and you can beat more people up than the next guy. That's how you become the greater authority, because they don't believe in pillar number five. And that's why Latin American countries or Hispanic countries are such a terrible disaster. They don't recognize the authority in someone who's weaker than they are. They say, oh, if I am stronger than he is, I'm going to become an authority over him and beat him up and submit him to me. And that's how disaster happens when that pillar number five is not violated. And pillar number six was the right to life. And we went into great detail on that. The right to life is another way of saying the right to liberty, the right to have freedom of expression, freedom of faith, and freedom. All these freedoms come from that pillar number six, the right to life. And pillar number seven is the right to privacy. And pillar number eight was the right to private property. We went into great detail about that. And we mentioned that pillars number seven and eight are private in nature. Obviously, the right to privacy is private in nature. The right to property has a certain private quality to it. That's why it's usually called private property. And then pillar number nine is the right to a fair reputation. And that right is such a fundamental right, and it's so sad that no one seems to be recognizing it. But it has to be a core part of our legal system, and stated in the Constitution. And we said the right to a fair reputation basically entails the right to make judgment and to judge people without the fear of them fighting back to destroy your reputation unfairly, just so that your judgments have no more credibility. And that's the angle that most people miss, or almost everybody misses, with regards to the right to a fair reputation. It's not that the right of, the right of a big person's, a famous person to have their reputation secured. So it's usually seen from the perspective of the little one smearing the big one, but it's really the other way around. It's the big one usually smearing the little one. The little one who dared to say something against the big one. And that's what has to be defended in the Constitution, in a very clear way. And then pillar number 10 is the one we've been discussing, the right to a personal domain. You have the right to be the king of your own domain, the king of your castle, and to have a certain freedom of doing things a certain way within your personal domain. But this right can be very tricky, because it has the potential of encroaching on the rights of others. And those are the 10 pillars of what will be the new American Constitution. And I believe that those pillars will be manifested. I don't know how long it will be, but because Americans just seem to be going downhill. But at least these are the principles, and it shall be manifested in a new American Constitution. These are the core principles to define a more perfect government. And it goes beyond just our American experience. I believe these pillars apply to any form of government that may be applied in any country. But we in America are supposed to be the example, the shining light on the hill. And we are the ones who are supposed, we have the destiny, the manifest destiny of showing the rest of the world what the perfect form of government is. And that's our responsibility. That's why these recordings are being made. So that the responsibility is being worked out, and then it will be up to the American people to come out of their collective stupidity, especially conservatives. I mean, liberals will go to hell. Pardon my French, I don't give a damn about them. Let them all die. I don't care at all about them. What angers me are the conservatives, because they are the ones holding things back. They are the ones who could have the power to change all these things, and they refuse to because they're too stupid, lighting up their candles to their constitution, their decrepit constitution, and to their founding fathers and their stupid mistakes. So we will continue talking about other things in future audio clips. These were the 10 pillars, and I am very thankful for your time and for your listening to these clips. Thank you very much.